Have you ever caught yourself doing something that contradicts your deepest values? Maybe you've claimed to support diversity while realizing your social circle looks remarkably homogenous. Or perhaps you've advocated for equality while unconsciously making assumptions based on someone's appearance. This uncomfortable space between our intentions and actions isn't a sign of hypocrisy. It's the human condition. Most of us genuinely believe we're good people, yet we occasionally behave in ways that betray those beliefs. Understanding this gap, and more importantly, learning to close it, forms the heart of meaningful personal growth. The question isn't whether this disconnect exists, it's what we choose to do about it. Research shows we value self-esteem boosts more than favorite foods or intimate experiences. When our identity as a good person feels threatened, we become defensive rather than reflective. Children's book author Sarah Weeks avoided saying her Indian colleague Geeta Vadarajan's last name for years, fearing mispronunciation. When they later collaborated on a book about a boy whose teachers refused to attempt his Indian name, Geeta called Sarah's behavior arrogance. Sarah was stunned. Her issue wasn't caring too little, but caring too much about potential embarrassment. When Sarah finally learned the pronunciation and used Geeta's full name, Geeta cried. It was the first time anyone had tried since moving to America. Worrying less about being good people paradoxically makes us better people. When we define goodness as ongoing effort rather than a permanent state, we create space for honest self-examination. We're all good-ish people who sometimes act inconsistently with our values. Recognizing this allows us to stop defending ourselves and start actually listening. Hollywood executive Perrin Childs approached his first documentary about autism with humility, believing he could learn rather than assuming he knew. This growth mindset enabled him to create the Emmy-winning Autism the Musical that genuinely centered the experiences of children with autism and their parents. Later, when co-founding Adaptive Studios to revive abandoned Hollywood projects, he faced a harder test. Despite the ethos that talent can come from anywhere, the show's first three seasons featured mostly white male judges selecting white male winners. When controversy erupted, Perrin made a crucial choice. He didn't treat diversity as the minority person's problem. He recognized it belonged to everyone. In fixed mindsets, we're preoccupied with not being wrong, which diverts attention from actual problems. Builders don't claim, "I'm not racist," but rather admit, "I have work to do." Perrin launched Project Greenlight Digital Studios with Brittany Turner, a Black team member, at the helm. They deliberately re-engineered their approach to dig into communities that are often silent, resulting in more diverse winners and a community that now skews female. Rick Clow, a Google Ventures executive who considered himself egalitarian, was shocked during unconscious bias training to discover he associated women with family and men with career. Like 75% of people, his implicit biases contradicted his conscious values. These unconscious associations affect whose potential we bet on and whose ideas we value, especially under stress or time pressure. Rick responded by recording training sessions and posting them on YouTube, sharing both progress and slip-ups. This vulnerability matters because our minds systematically miss what's right in front of us. Kimberly Davis, a Black woman and NHL executive VP, was ignored at a networking event for female executives. None of three groups she approached acknowledged her presence. Like students who fail to notice a woman with an umbrella walking through a basketball game when counting passes, we see what we expect to see. This bounded awareness isn't just information overload. We're motivated to see certain things and not others, creating psychological echo chambers reinforced by our homogeneous networks. When reminded of racial advantages, white Americans often report harder childhoods, what researchers call the hard-knock life effect. We remember disadvantages more easily than advantages, essentially rewriting our histories while acknowledging our group's privilege, but believing we personally faced significant hardships. Consider the GI Bill's generational impact. Of the first 67,000 mortgages, fewer than 100 went to non-whites. Computer simulations reveal how small advantages compound dramatically. Even a 1% performance rating advantage creates massive disparities after multiple promotion cycles. At current rates, Black families would need 228 years to amass the wealth White families have now. Privilege extends beyond race. Dress codes affecting Sikh men, unpredictable healthcare appointments impacting hourly workers, school events during workdays disadvantaging certain children, and office norms around family photos creating challenges for LGBTQ+ employees. Understanding these systemic differences, the headwinds some face and tailwinds others ride, helps us distinguish between equality, treating everyone the same, and equity, giving people what they need. When Christopher Owens was tagged for the 27th time by white friends asking him to explain racism online, he posted, "This is the new racism. You didn't start it, but you for damn sure aren't willing to stop it." His frustration captured how marginalized people repeatedly educate others, creating additional emotional burden. Research confirms his instinct. His white friends would be more effective confronting racism themselves, as their privilege grants them credibility and protection from backlash. This is ordinary privilege, the identity aspect we think least about because we don't need to. Studies show female and non-white executives are rated worse when promoting diversity, while white male executives face no penalty. One experiment showed high-status white male accounts reduced racial slurs by 50%, while other confronters were ignored or faced increased harassment. Most people avoid issues not directly affecting them because they lack psychological standing, the feeling it's legitimate to engage. Yet confronting bias matters. Even defensive reactions lead to less biased behavior afterward, like planting seeds in a garden you never get to see. Just one person violating a norm weakens its hold. Multiple challengers strengthen the effect. Rabbi Eric Solomon began his leadership at Beth Meir Synagogue by inviting Imam Mohammed Bayanoni to his installation ceremony, an unprecedented gesture that sparked a decade-long relationship between their communities. One of the hardest aspects of showing support is sitting with someone's pain when we can't fix it. Many people stay silent in difficult times, but silence is often wrong. Instead, acknowledge it's okay to be tongue-tied, keep focus on the other person, and offer specific help. Civil rights leader Joseph McNeil, one of four students who led the 1960 Woolworth's lunch counter sit-ins, finally said, "No more time for talking. It is time to do something." Despite his iconic status, Joe remains humble and committed to growth. When asked about gay rights during a lecture, he admitted, "This is an area where I am learning," and actively sought to educate himself. His only regret? Not engaging more with silent observers to give them the opportunity to be better human beings, too. This is our invitation, not to achieve perfection, but to embrace growth. Redefine good from a fixed state to an ongoing process. Use your privilege to amplify marginalized voices. Sit with discomfort when assumptions are challenged. Becoming the person you mean to be isn't a destination. It's choosing again and again to build a more just world.